This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to the Evening Edition with me, Umar Paganapake Pagan. Now, in this exclusive we have for you today, I speak with Tom Wright, the journalist with the Wall Street Journal, who, together with his colleague Bradley Hope, broke the 1MDB story back in 2015. They also have a book due out in September about Joe Lowe and 1MDB. I caught up with Tom this afternoon, and he speaks to us now, 3 years later, about this scandal that rocked Malaysia and the world. So, Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. Now, operating as a journalist, I suppose, you know, outside of our environment here has fewer legal roadblocks than it does in Malaysia. While reporting on 1MDB, did anything surprise you with regards to your work as a journalist?
Well, we certainly were attacked quite a lot in our reporting. You know, we had, we faced statements from the Prime Minister's office that, you know, said our reports were thinly sourced. We had similar reports from 1MDB saying the same thing over and over again. I think we were called at one point by the PMO a disgrace to journalism. And, you know, you're a journalist, as you know, that kind of thing just fires you up to do more reporting. It was frankly, very surprising because, you know, the Journal is known to have quite high standards of sourcing. You know, everything we do has to go through a legal review and a vetting review. And you know, our vetters and our legal folks have been very busy over the last 3 years on this story. Surprised? Yeah, I think I was because, you know, Malaysia is a democracy, albeit a flawed one. But I think what the 1MDB scandal has shown was just the extent to which freedom of expression was constrained.
I suppose in your case, the vindication was that legal suit that never came and, of course, the Pulitzer nomination as well.
Well, yes, I think in terms of the legal suit, we didn't give much thought to that. You know, it was a pretty vague threat, and there was a legal letter. Our lawyers took notice of that, and we just kept on reporting. Don't think what you do as a journalist changes much based on those kind of threats, because you should always have a high standard of sourcing and never put anything to print that you're not sure of. And we continually were very, very careful to give space to the former government, to Najib, to his office, to 1MDB, to always say what they wanted to say. And at a certain point, they cut off contact with us. But we always would reach out to them on every single story, on every single point. And that's really one of the most important things in reporting. The Pulitzer nomination was a great thing. But again, that's a capstone, really, to it. And not even, because the story continued to go on. It's one of the most unbelievable stories. So many different other journalists have been involved. Obviously, the Sarawak report broke the story originally. You know, others have done good stories, and it's really a dream to a journalist because it's just such a story that keeps on giving, really.
So, Tom, I know better than to ask you about sourcing, but I'll tell you the problem we have over here, I guess, with regards to everything that happens in Malaysia, scandal or conspiracy. One of the hardest things is getting people to talk. And I asked Claire Rucastle-Brown as well the same question. When it comes to getting people to talk, did you find the case with 1MDB harder or easier than your usual investigative reporting?
Well, I mean, one thing, without getting into sourcing, one thing you have to realize is that there were a lot of Malaysians who were very interested in getting to the bottom of what happened. It wasn't only the Department of Justice and the FBI investigators that wanted to get to the bottom. And so there was a local desire to see to investigate what had happened. And so, although obviously if you went in the front door at 1MDB or the Prime Minister's office, you were not going to get anything but spin. There were a lot of other people who were willing to talk. And over time, that cohort of people became larger.
Yes, and the barriers begin to break down.
Yes, but I wouldn't, you know, we've been doing this year a lot of reporting on North Korea, and I wouldn't say it was any more difficult or any easier. I mean, investigative reporting is exhausting and tiring, and you have to spend a lot of time developing sources and then getting lucky breaks. And so it is what it is.
I can't tell you how much it pleases me to be compared in the same breath with North Korea.
There was even a bit of overlap between Malaysia and North Korea. Some of the stories we did last year were about Malaysia Korea Partners, which was a Malaysia-based company that did trade in connection with North Korean regime, right? So, been a pretty, and we had a story last week about Ri Jong-chol, who was a the North Korean operative involved in the Kim Jong-nam murder.
Correct.
We painted his life in Malaysia. So, yeah, not to make too many similarities between Malaysia and North Korea. Yeah,
of overlap. So, Tom, tell me this. Talk to us a little bit about your recent report. I think a lot of us in Malaysia just read it about how Bank Negara Malaysia helped in paying off 1MDB debt, because a lot of these tentacles are now coming to light.
Yeah, and another story that Reuters have just broken about Khazanah.
That's right.
Basically, 1MDB has been an empty shell for a long time. You know, if you look at its financials, and we actually had access a long time ago to its board minutes, and you could see as far back as 2014, 13, panic in the board about, cash flow of almost nothing, huge interest payments. I mean, because they bought power plants and they were given some land at a cut rate prices, but they didn't really do any business, and most of the money was taken, right? So for a long time, it's been this empty shell. And then, not to get too detailed, but in 2015, $1 billion loan was coming due from Deutsche Bank. It's a syndicate of banks arranged by Deutsche Bank. And basically, there was an emergency bailout by an Abu Dhabi fund. And the government needed to repay that fund by the end of last year. And they didn't have any money. 1MDB needed to repay them, and they didn't have any money. So the only way that they could go about doing that was to try to sort of find other state entities that could pay. And it seems that the central bank bought land from the government, and that was put into a special purpose vehicle that went to pay the Abu Dhabi fund. Reuters have reported that the government had redeemed some preferred shares in Khazanah and used that money.
Correct.
But we've just reported, however, that Khazanah turned down a request to buy land from the government. So it seems that Khazanah stood firm and said, look, we're not buying land from you. And they've just put out a statement saying, well, of course, we couldn't stop the government from redeeming its preferred shares, and we would have had no idea where that money was getting used. But the point is here that, don't forget, I mean, some people are saying on Twitter that, well, the finance ministry had to bail out 1MDB. Well, they were saying at the time that all of this was getting funded by a rationalization program. So they were making out in public statements as recently as December that 1MDB had enough assets to cover the debt. And what we're finding out now is that doesn't appear to have been true, that they were doing all of these deals that we've just discussed to pay off the debt.
Not just as recently as December, but also on the little roadshow that the CEO, Arul Kanda, did during the campaign period before GE14 as well.
Yes, that's right. Yes, very good point.
So, Tom, here's what I want to know about, I guess, the process of your investigation. I mean, once the methodology of these deviant ways became apparent, did the pattern and picture immediately become easier to follow? Was it gravy after that?
No, I don't think so. I think the way I would describe it is that the Sarawak report broke the initial story about the money that went into Good Star, right? So think of the fraud in three chunks, right? There's the Petro-Saudi chunk, and the money that was taken, which, is over $1 billion. And then there's the power plant bonds in 2012. And we focused our reporting there when we came onto it, and we were able to sort of find out about how the money had been taken by these lookalike shell companies. They made shell companies that looked like Abu Dhabi Fund IPIC and moved money that way. And that money was really used, allegedly, I guess we still say, by Jolo to buy EMI Music Publishing and to become a big businessman. And that's what our book Billion Dollar Whale is about. It's really a biography of Jolo and what he did, what you can do if you steal billions of dollars, the kind of access that it buys you. And then the third phase was in 2013 with the $3 billion bond that Goldman organized that was done just ahead of the elections, and a bunch of which went into the famous $681 million that went into Najib's accounts. So I don't think any of it was easy. You're continually working hard to find documents, paint a picture. You know, what we've tried to do so hard in the book is to not just make it a money flow story, but to show what was motivating people, what really drove them, right? And what allowed it to happen as well. So the minutes of 1MDB were very useful for that. Scores of people in other countries who were involved, and the way that Jolo was able to move the money around without really being questioned too much, whether it's by private banks or the big four auditors or whomever.
By my read, there are two major tasks for this new government. The first, of course, is resolving this 1MDB issue. Now, in your opinion, do you think now that we have a more amenable government, that we have authorities that are willing to cooperate with folks in Switzerland and the DOJ. Do you think things are going to move along quicker?
Oh, yes, for sure. I mean, you see immediately after the change of government, the Swiss Attorney General put out a statement saying, I look forward to working with the new government, right? And they previously had put out a statement saying, look, we're not getting any help because the former Attorney General, or I don't know whether he's the current Attorney General who's on leave, or however you describe him, but he refused to cooperate with Michael Lauber, the Swiss AG. So they were not able to get some of the documents they needed. I think they got them informally from people who were leaking, but they were not able to get them through formal channels. And I think that stymied investigations there. Same with the Department of Justice. And I think Luxembourg authorities also said they were, you know, looking forward to working with the new government. So for sure, it will speed up those investigations. Also, I imagine although I have no inside information, the Malaysian government will now be able to go to look for a red notice from Interpol to get hold of anyone that they want to question. You know, and Prime Minister Mahathir has said that he would like to question Jolo, right? Obviously, there are a lot of other people who are abroad who were associates of Jolo and who haven't really gotten a lot of publicity until now that we get into in the book, and who are also cooling their heels overseas, who know a lot about what went on. So I imagine that's what's going to play out in the weeks ahead is how does the Malaysian government ensure that it gets hold of people it needs to continue to investigate.
Now, the second task feels harder, which is the government somehow has to make this intricate web, this intricate conspiracy, somehow understandable and accessible to the public at large. It is so incredibly complex, isn't it?
It's incredibly complex from a money flow point of view. You know, I'm not sure to what degree the government has to explain it to the people from a law enforcement perspective. One thing that the government seemed to do very well during the election campaign was to boil down 1MUB to its bare essentials, which was GST has gone up and you're feeling the pinch in the kampung, but other people are living at large, right? That seems to be the way that they portrayed it, rather than getting into the whole offshore shell fund game that was really at the core of this. I mean, the task force that's been set up is going to look into all of the different ways in which the money was purloined, but I don't know if that's something the government has to explain to the people. I think it's more that they just have to make sure that when they bring charges, this is backed up by money trail and evidence, right?
Tom, for someone who's been working on this story for many, many years now, you've been relentlessly pursuing the truth. What do you make of the revelations you reported then versus what's unraveling now?
Well, you know, it's more like the process of working on 1MUB has been like unpeeling an onion, right? You get a little bit more knowledge at each stage. And there's a whole, I mean, obviously you're interested in the Malaysia side, but there's a whole international element to this. One thing that we didn't know a lot about when we first started reporting on it was the Hollywood angles, right? How do you go about, if you've got a lot of money like Jolo had and you wanted to break into Hollywood, how do you do that?
Yeah.
What people do you, I mean, everyone knows that he hung out with Paris Hilton and Jamie Foxx or whomever, but what we show in the book is how he did that. And that's something we didn't know anything about at the beginning. And it's a really remarkable tale. He really was at the center of the Hollywood world by the end of it. And you know, those friends now have all blocked him on WhatsApp, or most of them have. Although he was still, as we reported earlier this week, he was still hosting parties in Macau as recently as February, including Nicole Scherzinger and Swizz Beatz. Swizz Beatz is Alicia Keys' husband, a very close friend of his. So he managed to hold on to those friends. But yeah, it was those kind of more human moments that really revealed themselves over time, rather than just the bare money trail. Actually really telling the story of who is this guy, where did he come from, what motivated him, how did he pull it off?
There is a cheeky revelation from the DOJ report, the initial DOJ report, which I'm not sure whether you realize. The Monet that they bought was the same Monet that was stolen in the Thomas Crown affair.
I did not know that. And you've told me too late to put it in the book.
and I'm not sure if that was intentional, because I know they're both fans of Hollywood and movies, and it felt almost like rubbing it in people's faces.
Well, whether it's true or not, it's the kind of meta thing that would not surprise me at all, right? I mean, the whole desire to take money and use that to fund the making of The Wolf of Wall Street, right? And to hang out with Jordan Belfort, the fraudster from The Wolf of Wall Street, is amazing in itself, right? And that's the kind of thing, that the kind of grand move that Jolo liked to play.
This is my read based on everything I've read from when you broke the story all those years ago to what's happening now. It feels to me like 1MDB, whatever the intention might have been initially, quickly descended into a vehicle to fund the lives of a select few people. That it felt like something of a scam to make a bunch of people rich.
Well, I think that's undoubtedly true. But one thing that was very difficult to pinpoint in the book was, what exactly did everyone plan to do at the outset? And there's reason to believe that Jolo evolved as the scam went along, right? So at the beginning, when they first do a deal with Petro Saudi, Jolo tries to get a broker fee on it, right? And that's not an uncommon way to do business, right? The people who introduce parties to a broker. And they're actually turned down by BSI, the bank that ironically eventually became the bank very involved in this scam. Because a banker there in Geneva said, well, they didn't like the look of Jolo. I think it was the look and smell of Jolo or something like this. They found it dodgy. And it evolves, and eventually they end up with this mechanism whereby the money moves to Goodstar, this offshore company that Claire at the Sarawak report broke. I don't know whether Jolo intended for that to happen at the beginning. And then you know, the other two major scams, you know, the 2012 and the 2013 phases of the scam. Again, I don't know whether this was planned out a long time in advance, or whether what I believe is that he really reacts on the fly and he sees opportunities. But one thing that's really stunning is that even at the end, even when, you know, Malaysian newspapers like The Edge obviously have played a huge role in this, were writing about the money that was supposedly in the Cayman Islands, and if 1MDB is in such bad shape, why not bring that back? Jolo is, 1MDB is continuing to raise money, and Jolo is using it to buy the Equanimity, his yacht. So he doesn't ever give in, and it seems very hard to see where he starts to cover the holes in the scam. It just evolves and keeps going, getting bigger and bigger.
So it feels like any resolution to this case is going to require Jolo. I mean, he seems like the key.
Oh, exactly. If you ask me, again, hard to know 100%, but, you know, where does Jolo sit? Where does Najib sit? Where does Al-Kabezi in Abu Dhabi sit? I think only Jolo has a 360-degree view of what was going on. He's really the one. I mean, and that's why we tell the book as a sort of the story of Jolo's life and his development. What Najib knew, well, he certainly knew that he was getting hundreds of millions of dollars into his personal account. He always said, you know, I didn't take it for personal gain, but members of his family, his stepson was getting properties in London and in the U.S. So, but did Najib know exactly what Jolo was doing? 100%? Hard to know. Amazing story.
It is incredible. One last thing, and I guess, I don't know if you'll have an answer to this, because I'm going to ask you to play soothsayer for a while, but how do you think this is going to end?
Well, you know, we were literally just putting the finishing touches to our book, and we ended it, you know, with attempts to, which we've reported in the journal, you know, attempts to by Jolo to get the Trump administration to intervene in the DOJ suits, right, using this Trump associate, Elliot Broidy, but have subsequently, obviously, developments in Malaysia have been incredible. I mean, you have to bet on the current government doing all it can to, when they've stated this, right, to get Jolo back to Malaysia to answer questions. I guess the big unanswered question is, you know, where is he? We had a story this week in the journal saying, you know, where he's been seen recently, which is, you know, Macau, Hong Kong, Thailand, Shanghai. I'm imagining that he's laying very low right now. And you know, will the Mahathir government be able to pull strings with whichever government it needs to get him to come home? That would be the big question.
Tom, as you can imagine, we're all frothing at the mouth to read your book. And so we can't wait for that to come out. But thanks again for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you.
That was Tom Wright. He is, of course, the journalist with the Wall Street Journal. He makes up the two-man team that blew the lid off the 1MDB scandal back in 2015. His brand new book, Billion Dollar Whale, about Joe Lowe and 1MDB, is due out this September. You're listening to The Evening Edition. This is BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my. BFM 89.9, the business station.